joy and grief all over again, as he had for the last 2 days. But he had no tears left for them now. The water was all gone out of him. And that was when his blurred eyes saw the smudge of oily diesel exhaust in the distance. A ship. Surely it was real. He tried to shout for help when he first saw it, but his voice was a ragged whisper, and all he could do was splash the water with one free hand and wave. Thank the merciful gods he had persevered. Had not Murugan himself rewarded his faith by sending this ship to rescue him? The blood on his scalp had finally dried, which meant he was no longer leaving a trail for the sharks to find him. But if he didn't get a drink of fresh water in the next 24 hours, he would die anyway, and the big tiger sharks could have him. He wondered if any of the killer fish had feasted on the friends he'd lost in the explosion. Probably not. The ship went up in a single blinding blast that broke the vessel in half and sent them all to the bottom, where he would be now too, if he hadn't been on the deck smoking a cigarette. The explosion had tossed him over the railing headfirst, his scalp splitting open when it slammed into the rolled steel top rail before he hit the water. He swam furiously to escape the suck of the sinking boat that threatened to drag him down. But panic fueled his furious swimming, and he escaped. Barely. He had swum back to the frothing swirl where the hull had slipped beneath the surface to search for survivors. There were none. But he found the watertight ice chest and clung onto it for dear life, as the current carried him away. He realized he was hallucinating again. Was he even alive? Or in some perpetual watery hell for his sins? He blinked his eyes, itching and dried despite the miles of ocean water surrounding him. He closed them for relief. He was so tired. He felt his mind plunging toward a deep well of black, comforting sleep. Atavan startled awake just as he heard a splash nearby. Panicked, he turned toward the sound, ready to claw at the black eyes of the shark as it charged him. But he saw instead a young man, white, like a fish, a smile on his face at the bow of a black rubber boat. Another man ran the outboard motor. "Hey, you! Hold on!" the man in the bow shouted. The sailor's eyes ached as he cried, or tried to, with relief. He couldn't believe his good fortune. He had survived. His wife and children would survive. The sailor glanced up at his salvation. He shielded his eyes against the blinding morning sun. He could make out the shape of the great steel ship in the near distance. A fishing trawler. Men stood like shadows on the deck, leaning over the railing, staring in his direction. The engine reversed hard and the rubber hull stopped on a dime near the sailor. The engine cut out. The Tamil sailor reached up with one hand to grab the hull, but there was no handhold. His fingers slipped away. He croaked in desperation as he released the ice chest and threw both hands toward the boat to save himself. But he was too weak. Splash! The white man jumped in the water and grabbed the sailor from behind. "Hang on there, fella. I got you," he said as he wrapped a nylon rope around the Tamil sailor's dark, emaciated torso. The other man in the boat pulled the rope toward him, lifting the near-drowning man above the surface. "You speak English?" the man in the water asked.
"A little,"
the sailor whispered. "Any of her friends out here with you?"
"None, sir."
"You sure?" Atavan nodded, his voice spent. His eyes pleaded, "Please haul me into the boat." "Okay, then, if you're sure," the white man said, still supporting his torso in his strong arms. "Time to take care of you." The sailor managed a weak smile, thinking of his children.
"Thank you, sir."
His blinking eyes caught sight of the second man in the boat standing unsteadily by the motor, the sun behind his back. He lifted an anchor and tossed it over the side with a heavy splash. It sped toward the ocean floor. Atavan was confused. The waters here were over 4,000 meters deep. An anchor? He felt the white man's grip release from around his chest, just as the nylon rope jerked against his flesh. Adavan's sickening cry was swallowed by the sea as his body was yanked beneath the surface. The two men watched the last of the Tamil's air bubbles break the surface a minute later. "Hell of a thing," the man in the water said, reaching up a hand. "We need to call it into El Jefe and clear out of here." The man in the boat reached down and helped his shorter friend out of the water and into the Zodiac. The taller one lifted a satellite phone to his ear as the short one cranked the big Suzuki engine. It was dirty work, but that was the job, the short one thought. The image of the Tamil's screaming face dragged down into the deep flashing in his mind. He shrugged it off. They'd be back on the trawler in 15 minutes, and Cookie would have hot coffee and donuts waiting for them in the galley. October 28th. Chapter 42. Washington, D.C. The White House Residence. He had given up much of his privacy when he took the oath of office. But President Ryan drew the line at his bed. The idea of a stranger's hand shaking him awake as he lay next to Kathy in the middle of the night was abhorrent to him, a breach of matrimonial sanctity that he could hardly fathom. The few times it had happened, it shocked him. He wasn't a young boot at Quantico anymore. He was a grown-ass man and the commander-in-chief. Wasn't he entitled to this last, least bit of privacy? Of course, he trusted the Secret Service detail with his life, and they had both the right and obligation to enter his bedroom and wake him under extreme circumstances. He'd defined extreme circumstances to SAIC Gary Montgomery, the head of the PPD, to mean war, or extreme loss of life, or anything involving his wife and children. Other than that, the door stayed shut until business hours the next morning, starting at 6 a.m. But Ryan wasn't so vain as to put his own personal comforts ahead of the national interest, and there were plenty of emergencies that needed to be addressed at the worst hours of the night. He gave Arnie Van Dam and a few select others, his children, mostly, the right to call him on his private number any time, day or night. When his private cell phone rang with its distinctive Arnie Van Dam ringtone at 4 a.m., Ryan's eyes bolted open. "Arnie?" "Don't shoot the messenger, boss." Jack rolled out of bed, careful not to pull the covers off his wife as he did so. He padded barefoot across the plush carpet and out of the bedroom, quietly closing the door behind him, and headed for the kitchen to make coffee. "What's up?" "You said to call you the minute we heard anything. I just got word from Admiral Talbot that there's been another sinking." "Where?" "The Indian Ocean." Ryan shoveled scoops of Black Rifle murdered out extra dark coffee into the paper filter. "When?" 2 days ago. "Why are we just hearing about this now?" "Apparently it was out in the middle of nowhere, and the local port authority didn't bother notifying anybody that it didn't arrive until 2 hours ago. Wasn't somebody monitoring the AIS signals when it disappeared?" "Somebody was out on a smoke break when it happened, or it could have been a software glitch. We don't know. Talbot's on the warpath and running this down." Ryan stuck the glass carafe under the running kitchen faucet. "This isn't the way I wanted to start the day." "Not good news, I know. I thought you should hear it from me, and hear it right away." "You did the right thing." Ryan sighed. He poured the pot of water into the reservoir and hit the start button, willing the machine to begin wheezing out the first drops of liquid black gold. "What do you want me to do, boss?" "Call the group together. We've got a real problem on our hands now. Bad enough this thing was running loose in the South Pacific. Now it looks like we'll have to police the whole damn planet." Chapter 43. Barcelona, Spain. Brosa pushed through the heavy door of the CNI office suites. She was greeted with a round of applause from Peña and the rest of the administrative staff. "There she is, our hero," Peña said, still clapping. Brosa blushed with embarrassment, but shook hands with or hugged the staff that came over to congratulate her. The story had broken on the news the night before, with overhead helicopter images of Brosa and her digitally blurred head charging toward the farmhouse just before it exploded. But everybody in the CNI office knew it was her, and proudly shared in her achievement. Drinks and pastries were set out for the celebration. "Everybody, please, enjoy," Peña said, pointing at the small buffet. He turned to Brosa. "Something to eat or drink?" "Just water, please." He handed her a bottled water and grabbed one for himself. He noticed the small bandage on her cheek. He frowned. "You were wounded?" "A scratch. It's nothing, really. I spoke with Captain Asensio. It must have been terrible." "Can I have a word with you privately?" Brosa asked.
"Por supuesto.
Let's go to my office." He led the way. Brosa endured more hugs and handshakes with a weary smile as she passed through the lobby. She was indeed grateful for their reception, despite her bone-deep fatigue. Peña motioned for Brosa to take a seat. He plopped down in the chair behind his desk. "I wish you would have taken the day off, Laya. You must be exhausted from your ordeal. Besides, you're a hero. You deserve it." "I'm no hero, and there is still so much work to do." Peña chuckled. "Which is why I knew you'd be in here today. Still, work fills the time allotted. Another day wouldn't matter, now that those cabrones are dead, thank God. You must be very proud." "I'm glad that none of the Guardia Civil were killed. Those idiots in the farmhouse shouldn't have attacked us. I was surprised when they did. Captain Asensio said that you were very brave. Of course, the news footage showed us that. Asensio and his men led the charge. They were the brave ones. I just followed behind them. Still, I think you can expect nothing less than a commendation for heroism, perhaps even a promotion. I'm recommending both to Madrid later today." "That's very generous of you, but really, I was just doing my job." Peña pointed a fatherly finger at her. "That's why I like you so much, Laya. So humble. But don't sell yourself short. A promotion means better pay, and a commendation for heroism moves you up the career ladder even faster." Brosa shrugged and smiled a little, uncertain as to what she should say. She took a sip of water. Peña leaned forward on his desk, clasping his hands together. "Asensio gave me a brief report about what happened. What's your take on it?" "Things went very fast after we arrived on scene. For a moment, I thought everything would resolve itself peacefully. Those animals didn't want peace. They wanted revolution." Brosa ignored his comment. "They asked for a lawyer and promised to surrender peacefully if the warrant proved valid, which it was. I assume the captain saw through their deception. I'm not sure it was a deception." "You think they really would have surrendered peacefully?" "We'll never know, will we?" Peña waved a dismissive hand. "Well, if that was the case, it falls on Asensio, doesn't it? He was the commander in charge. But any review board will defer to his combat experience, though I doubt there will be one. The case is closed now that the threat is removed and justice is served. Madrid is happy. I am happy. You should be happy, too."
"I am.
But I can't help thinking that a lot of young Spaniards died yesterday. Not Spaniards. Terrorist killers. They just happen to have been born in this country. Don't forget, they bombed a civilian target and killed and wounded many civilians. And for what? Politics? It's beyond stupid. Seriously, Laya, I wouldn't lose a minute's sleep over them."
"I suppose you're right. Still,
it would have been better to arrest them and extract intel from them." "Yes, I agree. But you know how it is. We train. We take precautions. We make plans. We execute those plans. But in the end, you can't control outcomes, especially if the other party is intent on suicide. Dios mío. It's so strange to me that they would rather commit suicide than fight their battles in court. They would have earned free publicity for their cause for months, maybe years here, and all around the world.
If you want my opinion, they wanted to be martyrs. And I think those bastards wanted you to charge in before they exploded that bomb to take the entire team out. That's why they threw the grenade. One of them must have panicked and triggered the bomb inside too early. You are all fortunate to be alive. Peña quickly crossed himself in the Catholic manner, but sloppily. Yes, I know. Very lucky. I'm just frustrated that the case died with them. Hopefully we can pull more intelligence out when the rubble is cleared. I stayed until dark, but the stones and timbers were hard to move and there were no lights. And the blood. Brosa's voice trailed off. I saw such things years ago when the Basque, were bombing the country. I know how you feel. It is quite distressing. You really should take some time off. Spend time with your father. I'm fine. There are just some loose ends I still want to tie off. I think there's a possibility the Brigada Catalan was working with another group. We still haven't identified one man who was killed at La Vie. She was referencing Runzo, only Jack still hadn't told her his name. And then there's this guy. Brosa reached into her purse and pulled out her phone. She opened up her message app and pulled up Jack's picture of the guy who broke into his place. The paper mask was on his face, and the black Nike ball cap was on his head. But the hazel eyes really stood out. She handed her phone to Peña. Who's this? No idea, Brosa said. But he was near La Vie when the bomb went off. I have reason to believe he might be involved. Reason? What reason? Peña brought the phone closer to his face and expanded the picture. Maybe reason is too strong of a word. More like a hunch. Brosa shifted in her chair. I thought perhaps he was with Brigada Catalan. But those eyes are hard to forget, and I have not seen them before. I've been back over the files of known Brigada members. He wasn't among them. Yes, I see what you mean about the eyes. Perhaps our files are incomplete. I was hoping you might recognize him. I don't. But then again, my memory isn't what it used to be. But I agree with you. I don't recall this man in any of our Brigada files. He studied the picture again. Where did you say you got this photo? Jack Ryan sent it to me yesterday. Ryan? Peña rolled his eyes. I thought you told him to go home. I did. He decided to stay a few more days. I don't care what Madrid says. That American is a pain in the ass. The sooner he leaves, the better. He's a nice man, even if he is a little pushy. Where did he get the photo? He didn't say. I was hoping this man with the hazel eyes was at the farmhouse and interrogate him. But then the firefight happened. I tried going through the rubble to see if he was among them. But it wasn't possible, given the situation of the building and the condition of the bodies. Do you have any reason why you think this man was in that building? Ryan thinks he's the bomber. Why? I don't know. But it's a lead. And I'd like to find out one way or another. If he was in the farmhouse, that means he was connected to Brigada, either directly or indirectly. Peña smiled with relief. That's an easy problem to solve. Once the remains are fully recovered and brought here, I'll tell the coroner to search for a pair of hazel eyes. Even if they are no longer attached to his skull, that will tell us something, right? If his remains haven't been completely vaporized, we might be able to ID him, and perhaps link him to whatever organization he's with. He might have been a loner. He held up her phone. Will you forward me a copy of this photo? Of course. She thought about Jack's insistence that Alexandre wore a Bluetooth, even though they never found it or her phone. She admitted to herself that it was odd not to find a phone on or near her because everybody under 80 had a cell phone these days. It was also a strange coincidence that this hazel-eyed man wore a Bluetooth, as Jack reminded her in his text. If all of that was true, it seemed as if this mysterious man might have directed the La Vie attack, which meant he had some kind of authority or leadership.
It seemed highly unlikely that Brigada would take direction from an outsider unaffiliated with any organization they could trust, and loners typically weren't leaders of organizations. I doubt he was acting on his own. We'll have to wait and see what they find in the ruins. Peña handed her phone back. But what if he was never in the ruins? She said as she forwarded the Biekov photo to Peña's email address. Suppose he wasn't. What would that tell you? That our only other suspect is still on the loose. And if he is, I intend to catch him and find out exactly what this has all been about. Or it could mean he had nothing to do with any of this. He just happened to be in the area when the Lavi bomb went off, as were hundreds of other people. It's impossible to know which, isn't it? So that's even more reason to find him. Peña laughed. Laia Brosa, you are relentless. It is your best quality. I trust you will remember your old friend Peña after you become the director of our illustrious organization. Brosa rubbed her head, trying to push away a headache. Peña frowned with concern. You're not well. Just tired. I wish you would go home and rest. She glanced at him, her eyes narrowed by the pain pounding inside of her skull. One last thing. This Samler fellow, is he still a dead end? Completely. Whatever Ryan thought he heard was obviously wrong. She nodded. Perhaps you are right. Of course I'm right. All that matters is that the people who killed Ryan's friend, and many other people, I will remind you, are all dead. Ryan wanted his justice, and now he has it. Next time you see him, tell him to go home. Brosa stood. I think I will take you up on your offer and take the rest of the day off. And please, thank the office staff for the warm welcome. Peña rose from his chair. I will convey your thanks, and yes, please do take the rest of the day off. Tomorrow as well, if you need it. I'll handle all of the paperwork. And I promise you that if the coroner comes up with anything, I'll call you straight away. She thanked him again. Peña escorted her to his office door, which he closed and locked after her. He tracked her egress from the CNI suite to the street below via the office security cameras. Once he was certain she was gone for good, he unlocked one of his desk drawers, removed a Faraday bag, and pulled out an encrypted satellite phone from it. A voice picked up on the other end. Peña was to the point. We have a problem.
Chapter 44, South China Sea. Guzman took another puff of his Marlboro, his pants gathered around his ankles. He was almost finished with his business in the cramped quarters of the captain's head, the only private shitter on the boat, and thankfully, his alone for the duration. He had needed the privacy. A dead galley refrigerator killed their beef stores 2 weeks ago. A steady diet of greasy fried fish and fish head soup since then had worked its toll on its gut. The boat's actual captain had to do his duty with the others below decks. Rank hath its privileges, he laughed to himself, taking his last drag. His encrypted satellite phone rang beyond the thin mahogany door. Guzman swore. That phone was only for emergencies. He needed to answer it. He quickly cleaned himself, yanked his filthy, fish-stained pants back on, and flushed the toilet, tossing the spent butt in after it. As it gurgled away into the black water tank in the hold of the ship, soon to be dumped into the ocean, he fought his way out of the confined space and into the wider but still cramped quarters, snatching up the ringing sat phone from the bed. He saw that it was Peña. The Brigada killings had gone perfectly, according to Biekov. Why the call? Dígame.
We have a problem.
Be more specific.
Brosa just left my office. She knows who Biekov is.
Impossible. How could she know? She doesn't know his name, but she has a picture of him. She thinks he's connected to Lavi.
How would she know that? That hijo de puta American has been sniffing around.
The one that Biekov was checking out.
Ryan. Guzman sighed through his broad nose, frustrated. It was too soon for DNA results, and the audio bugs had failed thanks to Ryan's resourcefulness. What concerned him was that the big American went on the offensive and chased off Biakov, nearly capturing him. Whoever the hell this Ryan character was, he was dangerous. Brosa is relentless, Peña said. She won't let go until she runs Biakov down. Why are you telling me these? Take care of it. Me? No, jefe. You don't pay me to kill people. You pay me for information. Let your man Biakov do the job. He's better equipped to handle it. Fine. I'll instruct Biakov to take care of Brosa and Jack Ryan. If Biakov calls you for assistance, I expect you to give it. Of course, any information I have, I'll pass along. Excellent, Peña. Thank you for the call. Keep me posted. Will do, jefe. Guzman killed the call. Peña was right. Biakov was singularly qualified to kill, unlike that buffoon Peña. Biakov was also loyal to the organization, his brothers in arms. Peña was the true mercenary, selling his services for cash. The Spaniard was both greedy and cowardly, and while greedy men aren't easily trusted, cowards were utterly untrustworthy, valuing their own skins above all other loyalties. Such men were treacherous in the extreme. Guzman picked up the satellite phone again and punched the speed dial number for Biakov. Brosa and Ryan had to die. So did Peña, preferably in a manner worthy of his cowardice. Biakov would enjoy that. Chapter 45, Washington, D.C. Situation Room, the White House. President Ryan sat at the head of the long mahogany table again, surrounded by his same trusted advisors. 2 days ago, they were dealing with an uncertain situation in the South Pacific. Today, they were confronted by a full-blown global crisis. Their faces showed it. The same map of the oceans of the world was displayed on the big screen monitor, but now with an additional 7th green cargo ship with an X overlaid upon it. That 7th X sat in the middle of the Indian Ocean, west of Australia. Time to marshal the troops. Anybody here as pissed off as I am? Ryan asked. That elicited a few nervous chuckles. It was bad enough when we thought we were chasing a Russian diesel sub. We had as much chance of finding that as buying 7 winning lottery tickets in a row. Isn't that what you said, John?
Yes, sir, I did.
But we did it, didn't we?
Heads nodded.
And now it looks like we're really screwed. Ryan pointed at the widescreen monitor. Whoever the hell was jerking our chain in the middle of the South Pacific has decided to expand his operations into the Indian Ocean. Any doubts they will spread out even farther if we don't stop them?
Heads shook.
I think this makes it even harder to find whoever's behind this. Ryan's eyes scanned the room. But I don't give a damn about the odds, because I'm putting all my chips down on this table, on each of you right now. He stabbed the polished mahogany with his finger for emphasis. And I figure that puts the odds back in my favor. He leaned back in his chair, daring them to argue with him. Arnie gave him a wink.
Good job, boss. We're still tracking the Glasov, Admiral, Sextate said, breaking the silence.
Yes, sir. Given the events in the I.O., it's a safe bet he wasn't the culprit to begin with. But just in case, we're following him all the way back home.
Can we take the Russians off the board altogether? The SecDef asked.
Not if the Russians are using more than just one diesel-electric boat, Talbot said. But given the fact the Russians called off the Glasov, I'd say they aren't our prime suspect at the moment.
How do we know that? Arnie asked.
We intercepted a Russian satellite comm to the boat. It wasn't secure.
Meaning, they wanted us to know they'd called their dog off? Arnie said.
Exactly.
Should we dispatch a carrier group to the Indian Ocean?
If nothing else, it sends a message, SecDef said. Carrier Strike Group 3 is on station in the Arabian Sea. We could redirect.
Maybe that's the point of all of this. Keep us chasing our tails all over the planet, Talbot said, and disrupt our current operations. I'd advise against it.
Agreed, Ryan said. But where does that leave us?
Sons of bitches, Arnie growled.
Maripat, we ruled out the Chinese before. Any new information to change our minds on that?
The DNI shook her head.
No.
None of our sources, inside or out, have found any mention at all of an operation like this.
Good. We've ruled out the Norks, the Indians, and just about every other naval power with the capacity. Sounds to me like this isn't an officially sanctioned government operation.
Ryan rubbed his chin, thinking out loud. We already ruled out the possibility of a criminal syndicate or a terrorist organization. Do we need to revisit?
Would they have the ability to run submarine operations on a scale like this? Adler asked.
First thing they'd need is a submarine. More than one, as it turns out, the SecDef said.
Talbot turned on a different video monitor and flipped through several screens until he pulled up what he was looking for. The webpage for Triton Submarines, a civilian manufacturer. They looked like round glass fishbowls on top of fat sleds. Some had exterior operating arms and claws.
This is just one example from one company. Triton makes good rigs. They've got one that's rated to 36,000 feet. It dives the Marianas Trench, the deepest place on the planet.
They look like spacecraft from a 50s sci-fi movie, Arnie said. Not like weapon systems.
They're meant for exploration, maintenance, even ecotourism. I'm not saying these subs are the prime culprits, only that there are significant civilian platforms that could accomplish the mission profile. But if you ask me, I'd say we're looking for a military sub-design, not one of these.
Any possibility that a civilian could get a hold of a surplus military sub? Arnie asked.
For the right price, sure. Osama bin Laden was in the market for one before the FBI nixed the deal. The problem is, you need more than a boat. You need trained crews, supply vessels, maintenance facilities. It's not like driving a paddle boat at a city park.
The drug cartels have operated at least 900 narco boats over the years. They're not subs, exactly, but they sit low enough in the water that they evade detection, Foley said. Mainland Chinese car smuggling gangs use something similar.
Those kinds of vessels don't have the range we've been talking about.
Arnie laughed.
Okay, I just have to admit it. I was messing around on the internet last night thinking about this stuff and came across this crazy story about the Russian Navy using a beluga whale for underwater cameras or something.
We still have the U.S. Navy Marine Mammal Program. Hell, back in the day, we trained dolphins to do all kinds of combat operations, Talbot said.
What are we saying? Sextate Adler said. We're looking for a fish?
No. But Arnie, I think you're onto something, Ryan said.
I am?
We're all loyal to our prejudices. We have the best technology in the world, but somehow, these assholes are beating us at every turn. Our prejudice is our high technology. What if these shitbirds are going low-tech?
Low-tech?
How does low-tech beat high-tech? Arnie asked.
Ask the Afghanis how they beat the British and Soviet empires. Not to mention the fact we're going on 19 years fighting them.
It's called asymmetric warfare, the SecDef said.
Asymmetric is more about tactics and strategy, Ryan said. I want to focus on tech for a moment.
Ryan pointed at the Admiral.
John, how can a ship or submarine avoid radar and sonar?
The CNO shrugged.
Radar is easy to avoid. Get outside of its range, or easier still, go underwater. Radar waves don't propagate under the surface.
And sonar?
Sonar operates like radar but uses sound waves. Active sonar sends a signal out, hits a target, and the sound waves are reflected back to the source.
Passive sonar simply listens for any sound waves generated by the target itself. You defeat active sonar by absorbing or deflecting the active ping, and you defeat passive sonar by remaining silent. And how do you absorb or deflect sonar waves? Diving deep never hurts, especially if the sonar source remains above the thermocline. But an easier way is what the Germans started doing in World War II, which was using rubber coating on their subhulls. We use more high-tech materials, but essentially it's the same idea. Electric boats are quiet because of the electric engines, but even nuke boats are getting damn quiet. Everything on a sub is designed for silence. Hell, submariners even wear rubber-soled shoes to keep from making noise when they walk. These boats are so quiet now that back in 2009, a British and a French boomer actually collided with each other, even though they both had passive sonar up and running. Anything else? I mean low-tech, Ryan said. Low-tech? How about no-tech? The fact of the matter is, the bigger you are, the easier you are to find with either sonar or radar. It's a damn sight easier to see a basketball than a BB at 200 yards. Smaller is always better. Ryan stood. So here's what I'm thinking. Something small. Something quiet. Electric-powered. Something that runs underwater to avoid radar. Something with sound-absorbing materials to avoid active sonar. You're talking about a damned underwater drone, Arnie said. Ryan grinned. Not me, pal. That was you. It was? Yeah. You were thinking out of the box. You just didn't realize it. But you said low-tech. Drones aren't low-tech. Drones are old tech. Nikola Tesla had the first patent on one back in 1898. A radio-controlled boat he called the Teleautomaton. Drones aren't new. They're just improved. Come to think of it, the Germans had a remote-controlled explosive boat in World War I, Talbot said. The damn Houthis have one now, running them in the Persian Gulf, Burgess added. They take speedboats powered with Yamaha outboards and pack them with explosives. Excuse me, are we going back to the Poseidon idea? Foley asked. No. I agree with John. They're too expensive and too untested for something on this scale, Ryan said. And it's pretty clear to me now the Russian government isn't involved with this. Drones can't be the answer, the admiral said. Even the autonomous ones are short range, except for the new Orca XLU UV, which we're building now. Fuel cells give it a range of 6,500 nautical miles. Nobody on the planet has that system now except for us. I know, but I wasn't thinking long range. Short range doesn't work. Sure it does. Ryan turned to Burgess. You remember the old Q-ships from World War I? No, sir. I've got gray hair, but I'm not that old. A round of polite laughter rippled around the table. Ryan grinned. Subs were the newest naval tech in World War I, and the Brits didn't have the ability to either find or sink them. So they started converting merchant vessels into sub-hunters. They put up false superstructures to change their appearance and hid deck guns behind the facades. U-boats would see them, think they were harmless merchantmen, and surface to take them out with their own deck guns, only to watch the facades drop and the Q-ship guns open up. Ryan stood and pointed at the bigger screen displaying the locations of the sunken vessels. John, can you pull up the map that displays all of the AIS ships currently at sea? Sure. He clicked a button on his laser pointer. Tens of thousands of arrowheads in a variety of colors swarmed across the sea lanes, mostly hugging coastlines, but many traversing the open waters. Ryan nodded toward the screen. Our bad guys are out there in the middle of all that. Hunters hunting prey. So you think Q-ships are behind this? Arnie asked. Not Q-ships. Motherships. You mean for the drones? Yeah. And tell me this. Where's the best place to hide anything? In plain sight, Foley said, thinking about the dead drops she used to use when she was a cowboy CIA operative in Moscow. She'd stuff coded messages inside of dead pigeons, dead rats, even dead cats. But disguised.
Exactly. You think one or more of those ships on the board are a mothership? Arnie asked.
Bingo. And if we can't find the drone, small, silent, invisible, we find the mothership.
Do you think one mothership can control drones in both the Pacific and Indian Oceans?
Foley asked Talbot.
Not likely.
Arnie pointed at the map again. 30,000 boats on the water right now. Could be any one of them. Container ship, cargo ship, tanker. Could be 5, could be 10, could be 100 of them.
He turned back to Ryan. You may have figured it out, but you haven't exactly solved the problem.
Like I said before, simple, not easy. He turned to the Sec-State and Sec-Def. This thing is too big for us to handle now. We need to start reaching out to people we can trust and get some help. You two get together with John and come up with a list of people who understand the gravity of the situation, and who know how to keep a lid on this thing. If we thought the markets might get rattled earlier, well, this will cause a firestorm.
Understood, Burgess said. The others nodded in agreement.
He turned to Foley. Let's find someone over at DARPA. They're on the cutting edge of this stuff. Let's get some of their people noodling on this problem, but without blowing any whistles.
I know just the person to call.
Do it, please. And do we have any idea if Buck Logan has had any success with his efforts?
He's putting his security teams on his company-owned vessels with automatic weapons and Stinger missiles, Foley said.
Do I want to know how you know this?
No, sir. You don't, Foley said with a smile.
Any other ideas? Ryan asked the room.
Heads shook.
Okay. Then let's get after it.
Chapter 46. Houston, Texas.
Buck Logan was a true paraplegic, having lost the use of his body from the L4, L5 lumbar region of his spine all the way down to the tips of his toes. His high T libido still raged within his broken frame. He'd turned all of that frustrated sexual energy into building an empire, trading a lifelong commitment to one woman for an unbreakable bond with his destiny. He transformed his previous talent for feminine conquest into domination of his business competitors, doing to them in contract negotiations what he could no longer do to the buxom young cheerleaders he bettered as a youth. While the lower half of his nerve-damaged body was unresponsive and weak, he religiously trained the upper half. He was in the middle of a German volume training exercise, doing 10 sets of 10 repetitions on a military press. His wheelchair was parked beneath a Smith machine with 45-pound iron plates on either side of the bar. Buck had the place to himself when he chose to work out there. The door to the corporate gym pushed open. Phil Worley, his liaison to all things Fed, especially DNI Foley, came through the door. Logan grunted out his last rep and rolled his wrists, slamming the hooks of the stop bars.
"Why the long face, Phil?" "Somebody cornhole your little sister?" Logan said, breathing heavily, speaking at Worley's reflection in the mirror.
"Just got word from a friend. Another boat's gone down. Not confirmed yet, but it seems to fit the profile of the other ones."
Logan unlocked his chair, ducked his massive head beneath the weight bar, and spun around. His face reddened. Whether it was reddened from the workout or the bad news, Worley wasn't sure.
"One of ours?"
"No, sir. Some Indian rust bucket. Went down west of Perth. The Aussies found the wreckage. Or what was left of it. No survivors."
"That's the I.O., not the South Pacific. Guess these pukes are up in their game."
"White House is pretty lathered up by it. They thought they had this thing nailed down when they cornered the Russian boat. Now they don't know who's behind it."
"God damn it."
Logan swore long and low.
"So I take it. Still no witnesses, no radar tracks, no sonar hits, and no fucking clue at all who did this?"
Worley knew his boss wasn't actually asking him a question.
"They're putting their heads together in D.C. on all of this. My understanding is that they're working on a new plan and getting ready to roll it out."
What plan?
Moving air, sea, and space assets into place, where and when they can. It's high priority, but not at the expense of ongoing combat operations.
You mean Ryan's only putting his Johnson halfway in?
It will take a few days. They're hoping for an electronic solution. There doesn't seem to be much chance of eyes on at this point.
Ryan hasn't panicked. Called in the cavalry.
He's as worried as you are about roiling the markets. Until now, it's still just the Aussies, the Kiwis, and us who were tackling this thing. But now that it's moved to the Indian Ocean, all bets are off.
And our plans?
Rolling out, as we discussed.
If the Russians aren't behind this, who is? Give me your best guess.
My guess? The Chi-Coms. I think it's a test of one of their new weapons systems, and a test of our existing ones.
Not the Russians, Logan asked.
Whirly chuckled. Ivan, are you kidding me? The Russian economy is smaller than Canada's, even smaller than Texas's. They don't want to pick a fight with us in the South Pacific, or the I.O. for that matter. They're more worried about the PLA Navy than us.
If the Chinese are behind this, what will Ryan do about it?
Without proof? I wouldn't do a damn thing if I were him.
And when he gets his proof?
Whirly shook his head. I don't even want to think about it. He snorted. Hope to God I'm wrong. I probably am. Even the Chinese can't be that crazy. I just can't figure out who else would have the capability of doing this. Whatever the hell this is.
Logan's eyes narrowed.
Daddy always said, bad news comes in threes. Another shoe's gonna drop. I can feel it in my bones. It's just a matter of where and when and how bad.
Logan dismissed Whirly with a grunt as he turned back around to the Smith machine. He watched the door close behind Whirly in the workout mirror as he wrapped his gorilla hands around the steel bar.
The world can wait, he thought. The iron can't.
He'd done his part.
Chapter 47, Oak Ridge, Tennessee. The drive over to the computer lab was another perk of the job. The green pine-studded hills and crisp fall air of East Tennessee lifted her spirits this morning. Parsons' spirits had needed lifting, as she dreaded the so-called emergency meeting Rhodes had scheduled via text early yesterday. Usually these emergency meetings were like nursing calls. Rhodes would hit the panic button, and Nurse Parsons would run into his room fearing the worst, only to discover that all he needed was his filthy bedpan emptied. Rhodes was a trained physicist, for sure, and not without some talent in the lab. He was also a scratch golfer. The fact he had a PhD in physics didn't mean he was good enough to drive the science at the lab any more than his par golf meant he could beat Tiger Woods at the Masters. She pulled her pearl-white Subaru Outback into the tree-lined parking lot. She found a space next to the sign announcing, "Reserved for Director Rhodes," and his silver G-Class Mercedes wagon. She killed the engine, keeping her eyes on the Mercedes, a vehicle she'd like to own one day, but never could on her government salary. Rhodes had been smart enough to segue into the private sector early. He made great money as a partner at a lobbying firm for a big defense contractor, before transitioning back into the public sector. Good for him. The man might not have been a world-class scientist, but he was brilliant in his own way, discovering early in his career that he was a supremely gifted politician, both in the boardroom and on Capitol Hill. The DOE had decided they needed a man like him to run the program, since it was a federally funded project. Quantum bits and entangled particles didn't fuel rapture. Money did. That was okay by her.
Parsons smiled at the uniformed guard in the glass booth. He nodded back a little too eagerly, his wolfish eyes raking over her hard, lean body dressed in form-fitting slacks and a turtleneck sweater beneath a lamb's wool vest. She passed by the sign in red letters, "No sticker, no phone," warning her that if her government-issued cell phone didn't have the required security sticker,
it couldn't be taken into the area where she was heading. No problem. Parsons was a stickler for the rules, particularly when it came to security. Dr. David Rhodes greeted Dr. Gate Parsons at the door, holding a cup of black coffee out to her.
I know it's early. I picked this up for you.
Thanks, David.
Please, have a seat.
She sat in the buttery soft leather chair across from his desk as he took his seat. Her phone buzzed.
Mind if I get this text?
Of course not. He watched her flip through her text one-handed, an unlacquered thumbnail scrolling through a block of words while sipping coffee with the other hand. She was a real worker. Parsons was an attractive woman, for sure. Not cover girl hot, but striking nonetheless, he thought, with her short red hair and dark green eyes. Those were hard to miss. Parsons was the kind of woman that turned heads when she passed by. There was an energy about her, due in part to her incredible athleticism. He chided himself for paying a little too much attention to her shapely figure whenever she walked into a room, and especially when she walked out of it. He was happily married. But he wasn't dead, was he? But it was Parsons' incredible intellect that electrified a room. Beautiful women didn't intimidate him, but brilliant minds like hers did. He was no slouch in the education department. A Stanford PhD meant something, but his brain didn't hold a candle to hers. But it wasn't really her brains or her good looks that made him painfully self-conscious when he was around her. It was guilt. If IQ were the sole hiring criterion, Parsons would be running the Rapture Project. But for all of her many and considerable assets, Kate was lacking in people skills. Sure, she was perfectly friendly and an excellent communicator. She had done a great job leading the initial team and laying the foundation for a project that would likely change history, maybe more so than the Manhattan Project. He always thought that it was fitting that Rapture was also being designed in Oak Ridge. Even the building they were sitting in was within shouting distance of the original graphite reactor. Ironic that the geniuses assembled to conquer nuclear power on the Oak Ridge campus so many decades ago didn't have a single computer to rely on, whereas Rapture was only and all about computational power. Much like Parsons. She was nothing but computational power. Her eyes bore through you like a laser when she asked you questions that you both knew you couldn't answer and made you burn with shame. She was always the smartest person in the room. Everybody knew it, and everybody hated her for it because she lacked the grace to hide the obvious. Now that Rapture was a fully funded federal program, new skill sets were required. It meant lobbying on the Hill, shaking the right hands, and turning the impossibly complex into the understandable for Washington midwits. For better or for worse, Rhodes was the face of Rapture now, because he was the one testifying behind closed doors in subcommittee meetings. Of course, Parsons remained the genius behind the actual work. She really should be getting all the credit. But neither life nor government-funded science were fair. He didn't make the rules. He just played by them. And played by them very well. He watched her close up her phone, grateful that she'd always been cool about the awkward situation they were in. He knew her second-class status had to be hard on her ego, but she never showed it at work. She was a real pro, and clearly dedicated to the greater cause of advancing human knowledge. Thank God for that. Without Parsons, the project would die a long, malingering death. Dr. David Rhodes sat behind his polished mahogany desk in the wide corner office on the second floor, an expanse of pine trees and rolling hills framed in the giant picture window behind him. Photos of Rhodes posing with congressmen and senators whose names Parsons didn't know hung on the wall. There were also numerous awards and honorifics he'd earned over the years, mostly for philanthropic work. There was even a framed photo of Rhodes receiving an award from the hands of Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Rhodes's office was located just 2 miles away from the Spallation Neutron Source facility where she had run into Ted 2 days before. A shiver ran down Parsons' spine, and other parts of her as well, after reading the text he'd just sent. The man showed promise. She slipped the phone back into her purse.
Sorry about that, David.
No worries. He forced a smile. Something was obviously bothering him. Rhodes was in good shape for his age, around 60, she guessed, and good-looking, in a game show host kind of way. He must have had something going on for sure, given the fact he'd been married for over 38 years to his college sweetheart, a former beauty queen and mother to their 6 children. Good for them. I appreciate you coming in a little early this morning, Rhodes said. I'm afraid I have some bad news. She leaned forward.
What?
I'm sorry to be the one to tell you this, but Dylan Runzo is dead. Her mouth narrowed.
Oh.
She sat back slowly, expressionless for a moment, eyes blinking as she processed the information. Finally, she said,
That's terrible. How?
4 days ago, he was in a cafe in Barcelona when a bomb exploded.
Maybe you heard about it on the news. She shook her head. I don't watch the news. I know you two were close when he was here.
He was a brilliant guy.
Have you two stayed in touch?
No.
This must come as a real shock. If you need to take time off,
no, I'm fine.
I mean, yeah, it is shocking. But we're already behind schedule.
Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure. The Russians and the Chinese aren't taking time off, are they?
No.
I suppose not. Parsons knew what buttons to push. It was a 3-way race to the finish line.
God help us if we don't finish first, Rhodes thought.
Rapture was just weeks away from completion. The bad guys weren't far behind, according to his contacts on the Senate Intelligence Committee.
I appreciate your commitment to the work, Kate. I really do.
She stood, a small smile on her angular face. I'm a scientist, first and always. Personal feelings must come second. I'll work now and grieve later. Rhodes stood as well. If you'll excuse me, I need to get back to the lab. She started to turn.
Oh, Kate, just one other thing. Since you will be here today, I need to add something to your schedule.
Sure, name it.
The FBI wants to speak with you.
Her head cocked, like a bird spotting a worm.
Me? Why?
About Runzo, of course.
They have a few questions.
But if that's a problem, I can wave them off. He began reaching for his desk phone.
No, not a problem at all. You know where I'll be. Send them along when they get here.
Rhodes smiled sheepishly.
They're already here.
Chapter 48. There was a knock on the open door.
Dr. Parsons.
Kate Parsons stopped typing and glanced up from her computer.
May I help you?
Parsons asked. An East Asian woman and a Hispanic male stood in the open doorway, both in their mid to late 30s. Off-the-rack suits, store-brand leather shoes, cheap digital watches, Parsons noticed. The Asian female held the synthetic leather folio in one hand and a leather billfold in the other, flashing her gold FBI badge and identity card with her name and badge number. The Hispanic agent did the same.
I'm Agent Kong, and this is Agent Silva. Is this a good time?
Parsons forced a small smile as she stood, extending her hand.
Sure. Why not?
Sorry to disturb you. Dr. Rhodes told us to keep it short. We know how busy you are.
Kong pointed at the open chairs near her desk.
Do you mind?
Please,
Parsons said.
Something to drink? Water? Coffee?
We're fine, thanks, the woman said.
Parsons sat back down behind her desk.
Do you mind if I just finish up this email?
No, not at all, Kong said.
The two agents sat quietly, silently scanning the Spartan office as Parsons finished up. No awards,
No photos, no mementos, no diplomas. They exchanged a glance. Parsons expected the visit. Rhodes had warned her they were coming. Okay, not warned, she reminded herself. They were just coming. A friendly visit to talk about Dylan. No doubt they were concerned about him. Nothing for her to worry about. She hadn't done anything wrong. Technically. They would ask her a few questions and leave. This wasn't her first rodeo with the feds. She'd been interviewed by them before when she was getting her ANACI and SSBI security clearances, and many times since when they sought information about security clearance applications for other people in her department. She knew the drill. In fact, she probably could conduct this interview herself. The questions were largely standardized, but there was one red flag to watch for. When they asked specific and limited questions, it meant they were just tying off a few loose ends. No big deal. But if they started asking broad and general questions, then they were hostile. Open-ended queries were just opportunities to say the wrong things, betray confidences, and confuse rehearsed stories. That meant they were fishing. And you were the fish. She finished the email and hit the send button with a whoosh, then turned back toward her visitors. How may I help you? Just a couple of questions, Kong began. She opened her folio and clicked a pen. Of course, anything. I believe Dr. Rhodes informed you of Dr. Runso's death. Yes. He said it was a bomb. He thought it was a coincidence. What do you think? That was not a good question. Way too general, Parsons thought. I have no idea. Why do you think he was in Barcelona? Again, no idea. I didn't even know he was in Spain. Parsons's gaze turned aside, presumably to hide her grief. It's terrible. He was a brilliant guy. So young. Yes, it's tragic. How long did you know Dr. Runso? That's better, Parsons thought. It was a very specific and quantitative question, an easy answer. She glanced up at the ceiling, calculating. I first met him when he interviewed for a position in my department 28 months ago. Agent Silva fought back a smile. What? Not 27 and a half months? And you hired him why? Kong asked. Parsons couldn't decide if that was open-ended or not. He first came to my attention because of a paper he presented on quantum computing, his field of expertise. He also came highly recommended by a Princeton faculty member that I trust implicitly. Kong poised her hand over her pad. And that faculty member's name? Dr. Craig DeBell. Kong scratched the name down. Parsons noticed that Silva never took his eyes off her, like he was conducting a visual lie detector test or something. She smiled at him. He didn't react. Why did Dr. Runso leave your employ? He said at the time he had a better-paying opportunity in the private sector. And what opportunity was that? Parsons felt the heat rise on her neck. There wasn't any doubt in her mind that Kong already knew the answer to the question. I believe he became a private consultant. And who did he consult for? I don't know. We didn't talk much after he left. I heard he was freelancing. But I have no idea who his clients were. Obviously, someone who valued his expertise. Something that took advantage of his top-secret clearance, I'm willing to bet. Any guesses as to whom he might have worked with? I mean, it's kind of weird a guy like that decides to live in Knoxville. I'd think he'd move to Silicon Valley, or even the Triangle. Dylan loved Knoxville, especially the craft beer scene. With his skill set, he could travel anywhere to consult. I'm betting he did a lot of work from home. Kong nodded. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. She made another note. When was the last time you saw him? Again, Parsons glanced at the ceiling, counting off the days. 6 months ago, give or take a week, I bumped into him at a place in Knoxville. It was just a quick hello. He was with someone. Who? A woman. I don't know her.
What place was that?
Myrtle's Chicken and Beer, the one on Market Square. Best damn chicken and waffles around.
Oh, man. I love me some chicken and waffles, Silva said.
It speaks. Parsons stifled a laugh.
Can you remember the specific date?
Sorry, I wish I could. Parsons smiled.
Oh, wait, I get it. You want the date so you can check security cameras and stuff.
I saw that on TV once.
Let me think.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was a Sunday. That's about the only day we ever get off around here. 11-ish, if I'm remembering correctly.
That's really helpful, Kong said, noting it. And that was the last time you saw him?
He called me about 2 months ago. Wanted to go out for drinks and dinner, catch up. But I turned him down. I was just too busy at the time. But no, I didn't see him.
And you haven't spoken with him at all since?
No.
In the time you were still in contact with him, did you keep him apprised of the progress on the Rapture Project?
No.
He was intimately involved with it for 2 years. I'd think he'd be interested.
Dylan would know better than to ask me something like that. He was no longer cleared for that kind of information, and I take this work too seriously to risk either the project or my own security clearance. Besides, he walked away from Rapture. He lost his right to be curious about it.
Speaking of walking away, I'm just wondering, in the weeks or months before he left, did he exhibit any odd behavior?
You're in a building full of eccentric, high IQ people. You'll have to be more specific.
Oh, you know, any kind of behavior that made you think something was bothering him.
Bothering?
Kong shrugged.
Was he acting guilty? Maybe becoming more distant or aloof?
Not that I recall.
Did he buy an expensive car? Maybe take a big vacation?
Vacation? Are you kidding? We're on a clock around here. Besides, they polygraph the shit out of us. Counterintelligence and lifestyle. If he was engaged in any criminal behavior while at ORNL, it would have shown up, I'm sure.
So maybe he quit because of a growing sense of anger or frustration, the crappy hours or lack of promotion?
No.
Did you see him coming to work late more and more often, or even missing days?
No, none of those things. He was a very diligent and conscientious worker.
Was he on any kind of prescription meds?
She set her pen down. Maybe smoked a little weed to take the anxiety off.
Not that I was aware of. Dylan was into hot yoga, if that means anything.
Kong scribbled a few more notes.
How about his relationships? Did he get along well with the people he worked with?
Yes, absolutely. He had a tremendous sense of humor.
Kong and Silva exchanged another glance.
Parsons' jaw clenched. She took a deep breath to calm herself.
And I'm sure you've already been through his files at Human Resources.
We have, actually.
Kong smiled.
Then you already know that Dylan and I were friends.
Friends with benefits, Silva said.
It speaks again, Parsons said to herself.
She turned toward him.
Fuck buddies, we used to call it in grad school. Nothing romantic, strictly sexual, but nothing untoward.
That's why we filed the mutual consent forms with HR. Dylan didn't think it was necessary, but I did. It was important for me to do that, because I was his supervisor.
Silva offered a slight smile.
That's very conscientious of you.
Parsons wasn't sure if his grin was supportive or condescending.
She had a hard time reading people sometimes.
Well, most times.
Look, we all work really long hours here. There isn't time for a social life, and we're told to avoid using apps like Tinder to meet people. That's where the bad guys hang out, right? Looking for lonely ORNL scientists to compromise?
That would be a really dumb idea for all kinds of reasons, Kong said.
Biology is primal. The drive to reproduce ourselves is coded in our DNA. We're all just Paramecia, but with bigger brains and opposable thumbs to access Pornhub. Every now and then, we all have to burn off some energy. It's like a square dance. You pick your partner, you have some fun, get a little sweaty, then it's over and you get back to work. No harm, no foul. Kong nodded and made more notes. Parsons saw that neither Kong nor Silva wore wedding rings. Sort of like the way cops hook up. Or so I've read, Parsons added. It was a jab, for sure. But she really had read that.
Yeah, I've read that too, Kong said without looking up.
So, just to be clear, you haven't had any communication with Dr. Runso in any form in the last 6 months.
Oh, shit. Now they're trying to trip me up, Parsons told herself. Game on.
No, that's not accurate. What I said before was that I haven't seen him in the last 6 months. We spoke by phone 2 months ago when he asked me out. Parsons thought a moment. I can request the IT department to get you all of Dylan's email and computer logs. The contents would be heavily redacted because you don't have the right security clearances. But at least you'd be able to cross-reference the metadata against people, dates, or events you're concerned about. Would that be useful to you?
Kong's eyes widened. That would be great. Thank you.
Saves you from having to get a warrant. Now, I don't mean to be rude, but I really do have a lot on my plate. Is there anything you need from me today?
Kong and Silva stood.
No. You've been more than cooperative. She extended her hand. Parsons stood and shook it, and Silva's too.
If you don't mind my saying,
you look tired, Kong said.
I'm working too many hours on a project that doesn't seem to want to end. But I don't care. I'm totally committed to completing it. I've given my life to it. I don't have any kids and never will. It will be my legacy.
That's damned impressive, Silva said. Parsons smiled. I appreciate both of you as well, and thank you both for your service.
Kong politely demurred.
Thank you. It's our privilege to serve. She turned to Silva. Don't you agree?
Oh, yeah. I love my job, and the chance to do the Lord's work.
That's awesome, Parsons said, turning away. Oh, there is one more thing I forgot to ask, Kong said. Parsons forced a smile.
Please.
You are willing to take a poly, right? About Dylan.
Of course, anytime.
I take them twice a year as it is. They don't bother me. Kong waved a hand.
Yeah, you're right. Probably not necessary at all. I just wanted that in the record.
You know how bosses can be, all up in your shit, micromanaging everything. If I don't dot my I's and cross my T's, I get written up.
Bosses, tell me about it.
Okay, well, thanks again for your time.
Sure.
Parsons sat down as Kong and Silva turned to leave.
Oh, geez, where's my brain? Kong said, turning back around.
I forgot to tell you that someone broke into Dr. Runso's home and ransacked it.
What?
That's crazy.
You think it's related to his death?
Could have been a couple of tweakers stealing stuff. But my guess is that someone was trying to find whatever top-secret materials he might have had in his possession, or cover some tracks related to his death.
Parsons' eyes widened.
That's awful.
Is my team in danger?
Am I?
I'm sure there isn't anything for you or your team to worry about. But please do exercise extra precautions for the next few days until we can get to the bottom of all this.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Thanks for the heads up. And we've notified White Mountain Security here at ORNL and asked them to step up their game for a while, too. You know, just in case.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Parsons' eyes turned to her keyboard. Kong smiled.
Okay, we're leaving now. For real.
Parsons didn't hear her. Her mind was somewhere else. Kong climbed in behind the wheel of their high-mileage, government-issued Crown Vic, one of the last in the FBI's fleet. Silva rode shotgun.
What did you make of Parsons?
Hard to read.
Silva chuckled.
But judging by the number of mutual consent forms she's filed with HR over the last 5 years, I'd say she was one horny little professor. Kong turned the key. The 8 cylinders coughed into life. She nudged the shifter into reverse and began pulling out. She started laughing so hard she had to hit the brake. "What's so funny?" Silva asked.
"Fuck buddies."
"That's pretty lame." I was waiting for her to start quoting lines from Friends. I took her for a cold piece of fish, but you can't always judge a book by its subtextual libido.
Kong shifted into drive and hit the gas.
"Let's grab some breakfast. I'm starving."
Chapter 49, Barcelona, Spain.
Brosa woke from a short nap and padded into her kitchen. Her father, Ernesto, handed her a cup of black coffee from the espresso machine. He wore a green woolen sweater and beige chinos, neatly pressed. Every hair on his handsome silver head was in place, and his beard closely trimmed. That was a good sign.
"Thank you, Papa."
"You're welcome."
She took a sip.
"So good."
"I pushed a button."
"You look terrible, by the way." She pushed her matted hair out of her eyes.
"A rough couple of days."
"You never told me what happened on the raid."
"It ended badly."
"Violence always does."
She kissed him on the cheek. She loved these rare moments of lucidity, when the father she grew up with appeared out of nowhere. Kind, literate, and thoughtful. He was a gentle soul. No wonder my mama was crazy about him.
He touched his face where she kissed him.
"What was that for?"
"Does there have to be a reason?"
"Ex nihilo nihil fit,"